This interview is brought to you by Sasswood, the makers of Wonder Bread. Our guest on this week's show is Lyle Blackburn. He is an author and cryptid researcher from the state of Texas. He's also a musician for a band called Ghoultown. He's been on Destination America's Monsters and Mysteries in America and Animal Planet's Finding Bigfoot. He's written two books, The Beast of Boggy Creek and another book called Lizard Man. This week we're going to talk about his various projects and his approach to writing and working.
So, you know what's coming next. Over subsequent evenings, something was creeping around on the porch. And, you know, it was getting a little spooky. Seemed to be walking on two legs. You know, it's up on this porch. It's creaking these boards. It looked huge. And they're sort of wanting to see what it is, but not really. So they see a figure outside. And they just weren't sure what it was. Well, one evening, they had no screens on the windows, and extremely hot down here, and even in May, they had the windows open, I guess, and a hairy hand came through the window, and they saw this, and they could see it was, you know, more of a human-like hand, and it freaked them right out. And so this all culminated on a Saturday night on May 1st, in which the guys were actually home, and it came back and it was creeping around on the porch, and this time they wanted to confront it. You know, naturally they go out and they confront, and they, you know, commenced a shooting, if you will, and confronted this creature. It had run out and moved to the edge of the woods, and they couldn't see it very well, but they fired 7 shots.
This is Sasswood, a podcast about Bigfoot. I'm here tonight with my pal, Mark Matsky.
Hola.
And our special guest, Lyle Blackburn.
Hola.
And tonight we're going to talk about Bigfoot and pop culture and horror movies and pretty much anything else that takes our fancy, because that's how we roll when we have guests on the show. So we were talking about comics earlier. What I want to know is what you hear later in the interview, but I've been on the edge of my seat for quite a while because Lizard Man, and I'm a huge fan of Beast of Boggy Creek. What come out next?
That is the question, and a question I ask myself on a daily basis as I'm trying to juggle all the things that have come about since I started writing these books. And my time to write has become limited, and I'm trying to find a way to increase that time, because when I first wrote The Beast of Boggy Creek, which came out in 2012, prior to that I had been in a band and then kind of stopped for a while to write the book, and the book came out. Well, the book was, you know, well received. I started doing radio shows like this, and then TV folks were calling, several episodes having to do with the Boggy Creek theme. And so in between there, and then I did The Lizard Man, which was harder to find the time to write because I'm promoting one book and then writing the other one among my various jobs, and at the same time still keeping up with the band on a management level. And then I've done more and more TV shows lately, which is great and thing, but it's now become a juggling match to try to find the time to do the books, and the books themselves don't necessarily make a living, so I also work a few jobs in between there. So I've been working to research for another book, which is a more encompassing book, whereas the first two were more about a specific case. This would be something more comprehensive that deals with many states, and so I've done the research, and I can say it's more in the vein of a Bigfoot subject, but I have no idea when I will be able to complete the writing of it. But yeah, I think it'll be worth the wait, and that's one of the problems. I'm very detailed and thorough in this, and it's something that I actually go and research. So now we're talking about multiple states, and I've been going to all these areas and interviewing people and putting this all together. So it just takes so much time, and that's the thing. You know, if I could just Wikipedia some stuff and write a book, maybe I could get it done. Yeah. But to keep up what I've done in the first two books, you know, at that level of detail and going into the areas and describing them, yeah, it's a tough thing to keep up.
What got you into not just cryptozoology, but what got you into any of this? You know, the horror background. As a kid, did you grow up on horror movies, or what got you into this subject in general?
I think what got me into it was being born. I was just simply into it. I can remember back when I was a kid, I don't know if these were reruns or if it was running at the time, but the show Dark Shadows, it was a TV series back in the 70s. I remember seeing that, and I was a little kid, and I could only understand that there was vampires and werewolves. I couldn't understand the storyline, but I was just so drawn to it. And then, you know, my dad would describe, oh, you like werewolves and vampires. Well, they used to show these films, you know, when I was a kid at the Tower Theater, and, you know, he would describe the movies like The Creature from the Black Lagoon and Frankenstein before I ever saw them. So that kind of contributed to it in my imagination. These films were huge. And then once they started playing like in reruns on TV, of course, I could see them. I could see them in Famous Monsters of Filmland magazine. And that's just kind of where I got started. And then once I started seeing, it's like The Legend of Boggy Creek and clips of the Patterson-Gimlin film, I'm thinking, whoa, you're telling me this, to you know, what is conceived as a sort of a monster exists out there in real life. And so that's how cryptozoology kind of entered my perception of horror and monsters and the whole thing.
I saw today on the RumOrg site that you had written a blog post about the 10 best or most famous cryptids, something like that. What cryptids other than Bigfoot do you have an interest in that you might not get the chance to write about them, but that you find just fascinating?
Yeah, certainly, you know, Bigfoot, there's a lot more to it, and so that's kind of my number one. But, I mean, I'm certainly interested in the whole gamut, really, and some of the more obscure ones, like the Lizard Man, which I thought was very interesting from the standpoint of just what this thing was, you know, kind of a modern creature from the Black Lagoon. So, of course, that drew my interest. You know, I like the subject of lake monsters quite a bit. And unfortunately, where I live in Texas, there's just not a lot of the lake monster lakes, so to speak. You know, a lot of those are located in more up in the northern U.S. and on into Canada. So I don't get to kind of research those. And people ask me all the time, are you going to write a book about this or whatever, or Mothman? You know, it's like, well, the way I do it, I like to go there and research. So Mothman is another one that kind of falls sort of into the cryptid world. I love that subject, and I've read a lot of books on it. The Yeti, always been fascinated with that legend, and, you know, read a lot of books on that subject, but yeah, probably won't go to the Himalayas soon. And Chupacabra is one that it kind of interested me early on with the Latin American version, but the business of four-legged canids running around is gotten old, and the media's kind of distorted all that. So I'm interested in that, but yeah, probably not much in the way of a book on it.
Gotcha. The Lake Worth Monster, I saw you were speaking at like a Lake Worth Monster kind of festival or something.
Right, yeah, that one's kind of one of these more like a family event. It's at the Fort Worth, Texas. It's a nature center. And Lake Worth was a case which started around 1969, in which people reported seeing described as either a white, hairy ape-like thing or something more of a goat man, if you will. And so it's something that's actually kind of a hometown monster for me because I was born in Fort Worth, and so Lake Worth is not very far from the Fort Worth city limits. And the case is interesting. It's one of those that, you know, a lot of sightings in a short period of time, a lot of news coverage, and then the thing just sort of disappeared. So every 5 years they have this thing out at the Fort Worth Nature Center because, you know, what's better to get a kid to come to the Nature Center than to say we're talking about a monster? So they have this from time to time, and this year I'm going to be doing a presentation basically on the history of the Lake Worth monster.
There was kind of a Bigfoot, or there were like horns or something on this thing, right?
Yeah, some people reported that it had horns, but more often than not, it was just reported as sort of a what seems to me like a Bigfoot with white fur. I mean, it's hard. And as I do a lot of these cases, you do often find conflicting descriptions of the creatures. It's like I found that in Lizard Man, where the media calls it the Lizard Man, and some people would say it had aspects of a reptilian, and some people said they thought it had hair. And Lake Worth Monster is a similar case where people were calling it the Goat Man, sort of an urban legend type of a Goat Man thing, and then, of course, they would think it had horns. And then some people said, hey, I saw the thing. It looked like, you know, an ape on two legs covered in white. It's hard to say just what it is. And there is one photograph that a gentleman took back in the fall of 1969 that shows the ubiquitous kind of a blob squatch, but in this case, the thing is white. And so, you know, it remains a mystery as to whether it was a white Bigfoot, it was a hoax or a prank, or, you know, or was it a goat man?
We just talked about a white Bigfoot sighting on the show last week. There was a sighting here in Ohio where a guy was out fishing and saw this Bigfoot come up out of a quarry pond. And I'm actually in the process of researching a sighting from Ohio, the Minerva Monster case. And something I'm going to ask you that has to do with what I'm researching right now is in this Minerva Monster case, this monster, this Bigfoot, was seen around the house near this quarry pond. And the smell that was associated with it was almost like this seaweed. They said it was like a seaweed smell. So these divers, after the police were called, and these divers went down into the quarry pond and they found these underwater caves down there. And they said, well, they thought that this Bigfoot was actually going down, swimming down underwater and coming up through these caves at the bottom of this pond and maybe living in the caves under the water. And there were, I had never understood why that was until this past week when I got down to Minerva and talked to a couple of the people involved with the case, and I was told that they actually found great mounds, what was called great mounds of hair floating on the surface of the water, almost like something had been cleaning itself in and around the quarry pond. Have you had any sightings, or not sightings, but reports given to you, or have you ever heard anything like either around the Lizard Man sighting or the Falk stuff or anything where you are, where it's like a Bigfoot seen coming in and out of water or living in a cave?
Yeah, that's interesting. Certainly I have come across a few witness accounts where people said they saw a Bigfoot in water. In this case, in particular, it was in a river. And I've also read or heard about a few cases where people said they were swimming more in a like a lake. So there are certainly reports like that. And if you look back in some of Lauren Coleman's Bigfoot books or in some of the theories that there could be some sort of an aquatic ape, and this might actually account for Lizard Man sightings, because as these creatures would, you know, come out of the water, you know, they would look less hairy and more wet, and that might account or explain reptilian humanoids. So you see this from time to time, and there is some even more conjecture that some species of ape actually evolved into an aquatic sort. And Coleman ventures to call them mer beings, but there's not a lot of you know, ironclad evidence in the fossil record to say that this is ever was ever the case. But basically, yeah, I mean, there are reports, and I've read and heard about these, where Bigfoot creatures are seen in and around the water. And in this case you're talking about, it certainly seems more, there's more to it, because people are seeing hair. There is actually caves down there, and somebody reported seeing a white sighting. So that's pretty interesting. But
yeah. Yeah, it's one of Ohio's maybe only famous flaps, I think. I mean, there were others, but this is the one that's caught my eye lately. Why don't you talk a little bit about the Lizard Man book? I know we'll probably get a little bit into the Beast of Boggy Creek, but Lizard Man is the one that I've read most recently, and it's such a fascinating book, and I'm not sure a lot of people know just the general story. So why don't you tell us what the book's about?
Okay, basically, this was a case that occurred in near Bishopville, South Carolina, and it was back around 1988. The sheriff's office down there got a call from some residents who lived near a place called Skateboar Swamp, and they said that, we got up this morning and our car looks like it was attacked by an animal. It looks chewed up or mauled. Not your usual sort of vandalism. So the sheriff sent a couple of deputies down there. They went to look at it, and sure enough, you know, it did appear that the car was attacked by some sort of an animal. So they called the sheriff, Truesdale, and said, hey, man, you know, this is real weird. You should come down here and check it out. So he did. And in the process of just trying to figure out what the heck's going on, some of the locals came up and said, hey, you know, sheriff, you know, this might be the work of the Lizard Man. Of course, the sheriff's like, you know, what? The Lizard Man? And so basically, what they said, that some of the locals in the area had seen some sort of creature, maybe 7 feet tall. It was either greenish or brown, walked on two legs, and the locals had dubbed it the Lizard Man. So the sheriff said, okay, fine, you know, if somebody has information on this, you tell them to come see me. Well, that incident got printed in the newspaper about the car, and that ended up leading to a young man and his father coming down to the sheriff's office a couple of weeks later. And the young man that came down there, by the name of Christopher Davis, claimed that something had basically attacked him in that area of Skateboar Swamp a few weeks earlier. And his father felt that his son was telling the truth and thought it might have something to do with whatever people were ascribing, whether that be somebody playing a joke or if there's some unknown animal in the area. They felt it was important, and Christopher Davis had a flat late one night, and as he was getting ready to put the tools and the tire back in the trunk, he saw something coming at him through the fennel grass, which he described as a red-eyed devil, some sort of a monster walking on two legs. It was reptile description, and he basically jumped in the car and got out of there. So that's where it all started back in the summer of 1988. And then following that, the sheriff's office decided, well, we better look into this. You know, they were convinced that something really did happen to Christopher Davis. They weren't sure, again, you know, whether it was a prank or if this was some unknown animal. But they felt like if they didn't look into it and somebody got hurt or killed, then everybody would say, hey, why didn't you do anything? So their hands were kind of tied. And in their investigation, they discovered that several more people had had sightings in the area of this creature going back a couple of years. And there were ongoing sightings that were happening as the investigation went on. So it's one of these that you often read about in cryptozoology books. You know, I'd heard of the Bishopville Lizard Man. You know, it's usually a summary, and it goes into a little bit. But I didn't realize how much there was to the interesting it was until I actually did a trip out to Skateboar Swamp and talked to a lot of the locals and talked to the sheriff. And, you know, it turned out to be a really cool story, just how this all played out. And I thought, you know, this would make a great book. And so part of the book is about me going to investigate it, as well as just the history of everything that happened and, you know, what's gone on up until today, basically.
Yeah. So when you get out there and you're actually in the field and investigating this to write the book, I mean, do you just, you know, stumble from lead to lead, or is it something where you kind of map out in advance how you're going to, you know, go about, because you have a finite amount of time that you're actually going to be able to investigate. Because, like we talked about at the beginning, you know, before we even started recording, we all have lives. You have a life outside of being an author, and your time in the field is limited. So, is there something, you know, where you've got your leads laid out, or is it just literally like Sherlock Holmes out there tracking the lizard man?
Well, yeah, definitely something I need to plan out in advance because, yeah, like you say, you just can't stake out a place for months on end and just see what happens or whatever. So I had, you know, I was familiar with the case already, and I kind of did some research and referenced some old books. And then I contacted Sheriff Truesdale, who's retired now, but he's still alive, and of course he was there when all this went on, so he's certainly a source of information. You know, and ask him, is there some witnesses we could talk to if I came out there? You know, who else could we line up? And I sort of used him as somebody to kind of get me the in with some of the other locals. And so I started from that, and then I was actually doing a whole run where I was going to various swamps all over the Southeast. So this was one thing that was just part of a bigger picture that I was doing. But I, you know, went out there and stayed for a while and interviewed him. And fortunately, he had literally a chest full of documents, from police documents to newspaper articles and things like that, that I could look at. And I scanned everything he had, which was great. And then once I realized how much there was of the story and how much information I had, and that I had actual police documentation, this was cool. And I thought, wow, this is a great story. And so, even though I went to other swamp locations, that ended up being what turned out to be the second book.
It's got to be such a different feel to doing the Boggy Creek book too, because Boggy Creek is so well known, and this Lizard Man story is not well known. So when you're uncovering these different aspects to it, I imagine it's incredibly rewarding, like every little string you're pulling on that starts to unravel.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, this is something that's, once I get done with these books, I can go back and read things that are online, and I realize not only that they're inaccurate, but how little of it there is, and how, you know, the more sightings that go on, the less that people even put anything out there. So I'm finding a lot of stuff and putting the complete picture together that's never been done before. But I did find it a problem, because people are like, well, I've never heard of the Lizard Man, or yeah, I've heard something about the Lizard Man, but you know, I don't know. I'm like, well, does it, you know, is it got to be the world's most famous monster that I have to write about? You know, I don't get that. People are like, are you going to write a Mothman book? I'm like, you know, there's experts who've covered that already. I think, you know, it's time to cover some of these other lesser known cases that are, to me, just as interesting. It's just that, you know, they haven't been beaten to death by books over and over and over, and it hasn't been well researched. So to me, it was cool, because I'm discovering something new and trying to put the complete picture together for a case that people can read about. So I found it, you know, somewhat a tougher sell, even though once people read the book, they're like, oh man, that was awesome. I had no idea all that went on, and man, Lizard Man's creepy. I'm like, well, yeah, you know, it's what you read books for, is to find out new things. I don't know.
Yeah. All right. I'm going to let Mark ask some questions and quit hogging the mic some more.
Now, Lyle, the one thing I really found interesting about Lizard Man was towards the end of the book, you go through, I think it's essentially a whole chapter talking about how this could possibly be Bigfoot, actually, or many of the reports that came in could be misidentified. You know, a Bigfoot coming up out of the swamp is wet and glistening, and it could look like scales. You just talk a little bit about, you know, maybe what does your gut tell you these reports are? I mean, I realize it's kind of explaining one mystery with another to say that, you know, the Lizard Man really was a Sasquatch. But what do you think? I mean, you went through that in an orderly way in your chapter. But having had some time to reflect on that, what are your thoughts?
Yeah, certainly in the process of my books, I never set out to, you know, prove these things. I'm somewhat of an investigative journalist. I go where the evidence leads. And in a way, you know, the reader is invited to come along with me. We're going to go through this interesting case. And if it leads down a road where, you know, a theory comes along that perhaps the creature was a Bigfoot, then so be it. We're going to explore that. And I think in this case, it was well worth exploring that because several of the witnesses had reported seeing a creature that was covered in brown hair. And I had actual witness statements that were written by the people days after this happened, and some of them literally said, I thought it was a Sasquatch. So while it's in the area where Lizardman sightings had been reported, I think it just gets lumped back into the Lizardman thing and not analyzed for what it is. But I wasn't the only one that kind of had this theory. Some of the early investigators also thought it could possibly have been a Bigfoot, in which the media just sort of called the Lizard Man. But as well, I find that in every cryptid case, if you really start looking at all the different reports, just like we talked about with the Lake Worth Monster, you get conflicting reports as to what the thing, you know, actually looks like. And I think one reason, of course, is that people are getting fleeting glimpses, or when they see it, it's a frightening situation. They're not taking notes and just, you know, looking it over. They see it, and their first mm-hmm. impression is, okay, well, it's not a human. It's not a bear. And in your mind just starts going off in different directions. And some people say, oh, I think it was, you know, scaly. I don't know. It was, you know, was it covered in hair? Was it green? So, you know, I always find in these cases there's, you know, various descriptions that you have to sort through. And to me, after having researched it, I feel like that some of those witnesses legitimately saw a Sasquatch. Some of the witnesses, I'm not sure what they saw. Now, that's not to say that they didn't see anything. Certainly, I feel like Christopher Davis and some of the major witnesses, they definitely experienced something. Something happened to them. Something came after them. I'm not sure if that was a Bigfoot or not, and I'm not sure it was a Lizard Man. But whatever it was mm-hmm. frightening to these people. It was a spooky situation. And at the end of the day, unfortunately, like most of these cryptid cases, you just can't definitively say what it is unless you say what it is without backing it up with evidence, which I don't do. I just go where the evidence leads. So it remains a mystery as to what it is. But I feel like at least in some of those cases, definitely, the people saw Bigfoot.
Mm-hmm. You know what would be crazy is if the Lizard Man was actually a Bigfoot and the Beast of Boggy Creek was actually a Lizard Man.
Stranger things have happened.
Yeah. Not much stranger, but stranger.
Not much. Yeah, that would be, you know.
Right. Well, there's a question I'm dying to ask you in regard to Boggy Creek. And it's, you know, it was a long time. I read this little book when I was a kid by, I think, Elwood Bauman. That was the most information I ever saw on Boggy Creek until I saw the movie. And once I finally got to see it, I mean, that first scene hits you and that big roar, you know, comes out of the edge of the woods. And my question for you, Lyle, is that roar, is that an actual recording of the cry of the Fauk monster? And if so, do you have any information on how that was obtained? Or what is that a recording of?
Unfortunately, that is a real recorded audio of the alleged Fauk monster. But it's certainly spooky and very effective because, you know, yeah, the film starts out, you're thinking, oh, it's kind of like a wildlife documentary, except for the kind of strange minor notes that the soundtrack will take. And then when that roar hits, it's like, okay, now we're getting into something creepy. And I tried to find out just how they created that. Charles Pierce is passed on, and I tried to talk to Jamie Mendoza Nava, who had done the soundtrack, and I feel like he probably created that. From all I can gather, it was created with a lion's roar mixed with something else to create that monster howl. Now, the howls had been heard down there, and like Smokey Crabtree, who is in the movie and well associated with the Legend of Boggy had heard these type sounds, but back in the day, they just didn't have the, you know, they weren't out there with good audio equipment. It's not like, you know, Bigfoot research today where somebody's out there with a parabolic mic. You know, the things they heard were, you know, they're not recording them. You know, they're just being heard, and that's it. You know, who knows if what you hear in the movie is anywhere close to what you would hear if you saw the creature making the sound, mm-hmm. but it's certainly effective.
Yeah. Yeah, it really is. And I think something I read, you know, you mentioned that the reports and the reality are sometimes miles apart. And I remember reading somewhere that those sounds were actually obtained in the field, you know, while the movie was being filmed, stuff like that. So, but it certainly makes more sense that it was created in studio by somebody. One of the scenes in the movie, Seth and I had the good fortune of hearing you speak at the Ohio Bigfoot Conference, and you went into detail about Herb Jones's shack and your quest to find that spot. In the book, you know, you mention Herb Jones, it's just about a paragraph, and then you move on, but you got into Herb's story a little deeper. Would you mind sharing some of that with us? What did you find when you went on site?
Yeah, that's one of the cool things that, of course, when I wrote the book, you know, I was privy to only so much information and time, but since the book has come out, I've had, you know, more time to research. And one of the things that people often ask me about is the old hermit, Herb Jones, from The Legend of Boggy Creek. You know, like, what's the deal with that guy? You know, did he really live out? And he really did. I mean, he lived out there for, you know, 20-odd years down on Mercer Bayou and was a hermit. And while I had been told where he lived prior to putting out the book, I had never actually been to the location. But being the Legend of Boggy Creek nerd that I am, I thought, this is archaeology. I got to go find this guy's old place and dig up some moonshine bottles or something, you know.
Yeah.
And so, you know, eventually I learned exactly where it was. I had to take a canoe to the location and found that. And the shack that you see in the film is basically, it's most of it's gone. The roof, the bed, everything about is buried in the dirt. So we took metal detectors up there and started digging around and unearthed big parts of pieces of it and concrete from the structure. I found his actual stove, his old iron stove, which I dug up and lugged back in a canoe and gave to the Miller County Historical Society Museum.
Oh, wow.
But Herb Jones, you know, he was the real deal. He was a real hermit and kind of a man of days gone by that could live out there off the land and nobody really knew where he lived and nobody really bothered him. He eventually fell through the bottom of his shack and froze to death.
Oh my gosh.
I don't know who found him. But yeah, it was kind of a tragic end. And I've since learned that, you know, he lived in California for a while. I mean, this guy had been around. I mean, it's almost, you know, you can maybe write a book on this guy, you know, if I could mention. It's really interesting and, you know, just sort of a caveat in the middle of Legend of Boggy Creek. But to me, you know, as I said, just being a total nerd, it's something that fascinates me and was cool to just dig up some of his stuff.
Right. And you said something that made a lot of sense, which is, you know, he's famous in that movie for saying, I haven't seen anything out here and I live out here, you know, but you said, hey, look, if you're a hermit and you want to live out there and stay by yourself, you're not going to say, oh yeah, I see Bigfoot out here all the time. So I thought that was pretty, that made a lot of sense. That was pretty insightful. He's just, whether he saw anything or not, you know?
Right. It used to kind of depress me because I thought, man, this guy hasn't seen it. I mean, he's been out there all those years. And as I've since learned, he is in a place where sightings have been reported very recently, actually. And I thought, man, you know, if he didn't see it, that's not good for the case. But then I started thinking, wait a minute. This dude, yeah, he wants to be left alone. What is he going to say? Oh, I see it down here all the time. You know, everybody's going to come down there. So
exactly.
Yeah, maybe he knew more than he let on to.
Yeah, pretty wise man, probably, I'm thinking. Yeah. One thing also that really struck me going through your book again was the fact that the tracks that have been found and casted, at least, you know, in the 60s, were all three-toed tracks. And so you put that together with a few other elements like Lynn Crabtree's experience, you know, where he says he's like, what, 30 paces from the creature and he can't hit it with a shotgun, or he's trying, you know, or maybe he hits it and nothing happens. And that skirts the edge of high strangeness. Do you think that there's any really, you know, some of those high strangeness elements to this Falk monster case, or is it more of an organic creature, in your opinion?
I think by and large it's organic, and by most descriptions and by most experiences people have with it, it seems like a biologically based creature. However, there's always those few reports which you just can't quite add up, and Lynn Crabtree's was one, which occurred back in about 1965. We was out squirrel hunting and kind of dozed off and woke up and saw this thing standing, 30 or 40 feet from him, close enough range. He takes some shots at it with a shotgun, and he was frightened and ran off. I don't know how to reconcile that. He threw a few things in the book as to maybe either explain it or whatever, but at the end of the day, you combine that with the fact that people report three-toed tracks, and you're dealing with something that is a little bit out of the norm for a biological entity. However, I was never too convinced with a three-toed track situation. And I talk about this in the book, whereas the most famous case, which is dramatized in The Legend of Boggy Creek, where they find those three-toed tracks across the bean field in 1971, I'm not so sure those are all that authentic. And I think some of the other tracks could have been interpreted as three-toed because they were very sketchy. They never had, other than the one in the bean field, the tracks were never very well-defined in the soil. And Constable Walraven just sort of mentioned, kind of like a three-toed track. And that appeared in the very first article in the Texarkana Gazette. And I think that kind of got that whole thing going, as far as three-toed, but, you know, there have been reports of five-toed tracks down there, and so I'm still hung jury on whether the thing could actually have three toes, or it's just either, an incomplete track, or, you know, one creature that has some inbreeding problems, or just whatever, which remain a mystery until perhaps more evidence is found.
Yeah. And one more thing, Lyle. What's the most recent report that you've heard that's come your way coming out of the Falk area? Anything going on there in the relative recent past?
Actually, yeah, to piggyback on that one, let me add to that. Have there been regular reports out of there since those initial ones, or did it kind of die off and reports would just come up here and there?
Well, there was the big flap in the early 70s, which sort of drew film director Charles Pierce in there to do the movie. But, of course, once those started getting printed in the paper, just like the Lizard Man and everything else, some of the old-timers or people who live there say, hey, you know, there's been sightings that have gone on in the past. And it seems like once the hype and the news people get tired of it, then there are still reports coming out, but they're just not being covered in the newspaper, and it's harder to find these. And I found this to be the case in The Legend of Boggy Creek, where, it almost implies that everything went on in the 70s. And when I started the book, I think what is going to be purely a historical book, but what I found was there are reports that have occurred, with a fairly consistent frequency ever since then. And my book goes up to reports from 2010. That's where I left off before I, turned in the manuscript and it, came out a year later or whatever. And there had been some very compelling reports that had occurred in the 90s, the 2000s, all the way up. And then most recently, in the last couple of years, there's been several reports that I've learned about that seem fairly credible. And in one case, the latest report occurred right in that area of Mercer Bayou where Herb Jones lived. And in this case, a resident saw a juvenile creature that sort of ran off into the swampy water. The guy had to go, he lost track of it, went back, got his canoe, got in the water, and tried to pursue it. And eventually it got dark and he never could find it again, although he could hear it making a cry. So if that's a substantial report, then, you know, this has us current to January. And I'm sure that things happen that don't get reported to anyone down there. You know, I mean, not everybody runs to the computer to report it or goes to the newspaper. So who knows what else. But at least some of these come across my radar, and I document those, and I try to list them on my falconmonster.net website just to kind of give people those extra pieces beyond the book. So, yeah, they're still being reported.
So you're a big horror movie fan. We just did an episode about Bigfoot movies. What are some of your Bigfoot movie favorites?
Well, certainly The Legend of Boggy Creek has got a great ride up there. Let's see, I like the Hammer film, The Abominable Snowman, Peter Cushing. That's a great classic. The Legend of Sasquatch or Bigfoot, the Legend of Sasquatch, the one in the late 70s where they go out on horseback. Mm-hmm. I always mix up these titles because they're all called about the same thing.
Right.
Legend,
the same thing.
I think that's Sasquatch, The Legend of Bigfoot.
Sasquatch, The Legend of Bigfoot. They wanted to get both. Get it all right.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, that one I like a lot. Kind of Patterson-Gimlin-esque in the way they go out with the horses. I love that one. Let's see. Recently, there's been a rash of really bad ones and really good ones. Hunting the Legend. I saw that. I get to review all these for Rue Morgue usually, so I get screeners. That one was a no-go for me. But Willow Creek by Bobcat Goldthwait I thought was very excellent. Just simply an entertaining movie, which a lot of times people making Bigfoot movies don't realize that first and foremost you need to make an entertaining movie. Yeah. Just the fact that it's about Bigfoot is not enough to carry a film. So I thought Willow Creek was great. I've seen Exists, which comes out October 24th. That was directed by Eduardo Sanchez of the Blair Witch fame. Man, I'm thinking this has got to be the greatest Bigfoot movie ever made.
Whoa.
He tried to reflect that feel of the 1970s. Like me, he was a kid who had seen the Patterson-Gimlin film, The Legend of Boggy Creek, at a time when he was young, and he's kind of tried to bring that back. No CGI, no nonsense, over-the-top, frightening Bigfoot film. It's totally excellent. I do a feature on it in Rue Morgue, which actually comes out in the issue tomorrow, the October issue. So I talk about that, but it comes on later this month. I recently saw Bigfoot Wars, which I'm trying to figure out how to review that, but I'm a fan. Have you guys read Eric S. Brown's Bigfoot War books?
I just started the first one last week.
Okay. It's a very down-to-earth, simple approach to a Bigfoot theme, which Brown, I think, does very well in the first book, for sure. Well, somebody bought film rights to this and put out this movie, Bigfoot Wars, but apparently they did not read Eric's books. That's the weird part. So I thought Bigfoot Wars is horrible. It's directed by the guy that did that movie Boggy Creek, The Legend is True from 2010.
Oh, yeah.
I know it.
You know that one? Well, he that's better than Bigfoot Wars. You know what I'm saying? And Instead of basing Bigfoot Wars in Babel Creek, North Carolina, where Eric S. Brown based his, where did they move it? To this ubiquitous Boggy Creek. Which I'm like, it's just starting to get it. You know, I love Bigfoot. I love Bigfoot movies, but come on, let's stop doing a disservice to Charles Pierce's great work in The Legend of Boggy Creek and call every Bigfoot movie something to do with Boggy Creek and then do an atrocious job. So that's my rant.
I'm fired up to hear you say that about Exists, because I was super pumped up for that. Blair Witch is actually a movie that I think has aged really well, and I was very excited to hear he was involved in this. And then the first trailer came out, and I didn't know what to think, because to me it looked like kind of a Cabin in the Woods kind of a thing, very stereotypical. But to hear you say that kind of brings me back around, because I'm excited to see it.
And, it is kind of it's a found footage based thing, and unfortunately the Cabin in the Woods thing has been done to death by people who haven't done it correctly. So in some ways I was like, I felt like you, but you see, just the setup is just right, and the way he delivers the Bigfoot action, it's done as good as any Bigfoot movie can be done, I think. And wow. I mean, there's one scene out of there where I just play it in my head all the time, because it was just like, it's almost one of the coolest scenes I've seen in a horror movie lately, much less a Bigfoot movie. It's just super cool. Some of the camera work they do, and the creature costume, hands down, awesome.
Wow.
But yeah, I think overall it's well done, and maybe that'll get people to quit asking me if I'm going to do a remake of Legend of Boggy Creek or a movie. Because while I think I could probably do one better than some people, I'm not a movie maker, and I don't want to set out. But now I think Ed Sanchez has done the work that everybody's hoping for. And
awesome. So
there you go.
Great. All right, before we let you go, I got to know, you were here in Ohio for the conference. What do you think of Ohio squatch-wise? Do you think, did it seem like a good habitat? What do you think?
Definitely. Yeah, I think so. And I think I've been to Ohio a few times in the past, but, this time I came in looking, with eyes and the, looking at it from the perspective of a Bigfoot researcher. And I think it definitely stands up to being a great, Sasquatch habitat. And the more I learn about Ohio, it's got to be one of the best hot spots for sightings and reports and activity in the U.S. Time and time again since, reports from the 70s on up, there's just some amazing reports coming out of there. And I think it's backed up by the terrain and the environment, which can obviously support a creature like this. I think Ohio is a great place, and I wish I had more time to just like come up to some of these things like that and actually do some more considerable research in the field. But, again, it's like economics and time always prevent me from just traveling the globe in search of Sasquatch indefinitely, which would be great, but I can't find that wealthy millionaire to fork over some money so I can do that.
He's out there. Just keep looking. Yeah. Maybe that's who Bigfoot is. All right, tell us where we can go online to find your stuff.
A good place to start would be my website, Lyle Blackburn, L-Y-L-E, Blackburn.com. And that, of course, has links to information on both of my books, the places I'm going to be appearing, because I do appear at different conferences around the country when possible, do book signings. If you want to know more about the Falk Monster, the Boggy Creek case, go to falkmonster.net, F-O-U-K-E, monster.net. I've got a lot of additional information there and historical archives up and above what's in my book. Just check out my website, and if you if you've had a interesting sighting in my areas, my southern areas, definitely drop me a line and let me know about your case, because I'm doing some research on the southern areas now, so I always like to hear from people.
Awesome. Well, thanks for coming on.
And wind and water, here beneath the bright blue sky, no man's smoke blinds the eagle's eye, things that crawl or swim or fly.
Join the conversation at facebook.com/sasswhat. Find us on Twitter by using the hashtag sasswhat, or you can find me on Twitter at Seth Breedslove. Mark Matsky is on Twitter at Reverend Matsky. Send your letters to sasswhatmail@gmail.com and leave us a rating and review on iTunes.